Welcome to our Local Voices special presentation called A Glance Back on 94.7 KPIP LP Fayette. A Glance Back is brought to you by the Boonslick Historical Society and its president, respected Fayette community member Jim Steele, journalist, graphic designer, and local historian. Local Voices, A Glance Back, a two-hour program, airs every Monday and Friday starting at noon and then again at 4 p.m. The show focuses on the music, radio features, and history of World War II and beyond as it affected Fayette, America, and the world. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
We'll be right back.
You are listening to Local Voices on 94.7 KPIP. Now, our local historian, Jim Steele, will take us back to the age of World War II.
This is KPIP Radio, 94.7 FM. And today, we again welcome you to Local Voices, A Glance Back. I'm Jim Steele reporting under the sponsorship of the Boone's Lick Historical Society. Well, as you may recall from last week, we initiated a new series which examines how Howard County's transportation evolved over the years, from riverboats to stagecoaches to trains and eventually highways. Initially, we talked about the steamboats on the Missouri River, which brought goods and early settlers to the state, in addition to the involvement of trails allowing transportation eventually by stagecoach. But in the years preceding the Civil War, Howard County residents were agitating for a rail line. Unfortunately, several missteps caused Fayette and other locales to lose at least two opportunities for a railroad by reason of a short-sighted policy that would hold fast and make no concessions. Eventually, this left Fulton, Columbia, and Fayette without any rail facilities for many years. But soon the Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railroad, MKT, came along, as we saw it, better known as the MKT, and that's what we're going to pick up. County officials had subscribed earlier to $350,000 in bonds to what was called the Louisiana and Missouri River Railroad, and they also issued $400,000 in bonds to the Thibault and Neosho Railroad, which was later absorbed by a larger enterprise extending through Sedalia, Houdinson, Texas. And again, that was known as the MKT. Levi Parsons, then chief executive officer of the MKT, had visions of extending his railroad from Sedalia to Chicago. For that reason, became interested in the line between Boonville and Moberly, which of course came through Fayette, that would connect then with the North Missouri Railroad, later the Wabash. That connection would take place at Moberly and then on to St. Louis. Later, he expected to push through to Hannibal and connect with the Toledo, Wabash, and Western Railroad, and then on up to Quincy, Illinois, to meet the CB and Q, and on to Chicago. This line was designed to break the stranglehold held by the Missouri Pacific, which was breaking all connections with the Katy trains and canceling all traffic agreements with the Katy at Sedalia in order to strangle the Katy at that point. A contract then was closed to build the line, in addition to a $1 million bridge across the Missouri River between Boonville and Franklin within at least 18 months. The very threat of the Katy building a connection with the North Missouri Railroad at Moberly would, they said, provide a road of terror to hold over the heads of the Missouri Pacific. Now they would not dare to slam the Sedalia Gateway shut. On May 18, 1873, the end of track reached Boonville. In the meantime, grading had been completed and track laying commenced in May on the north side of the river in Howard County. Construction was started at both ends at the same time. The 10-mile stretch from Moberly to Higbee was finished on May 15th of 1873, and the stretch north of the river through Franklin was completed about the same time. The two crews met at Fayette on June 20th, 1873. Incidentally, a cholera epidemic broke out here and then raged throughout the summer. This misfortune was charged to the Katy Railroad, but history records no true cause of the outbreak. A big celebration to mark the completion of the northeastern extension of the Katy was held at Boonville on July the 4th. Now, the line was still minus a bridge over the river, but cars were ferried across the river until the structure was completed. The first Katy train crossing on the bridge took place on January 10th, 1874. Now, one might expect that with the completion of the railroad through Fayette and Howard County, the region was at the peak of its progress. Despite these evidences of progress, and although the county had been around for some 50 years, it still carried the marks of the frontier. Central Missouri, indeed, was still open country and still the land of opportunity. The Katy then served Fayette until the mid-1970s. Now, the next time you happen to be at the CNR grocery, glance across Highway 240 at Church Street from the store's parking lot, and you'll see Dollar General. This was the site, Fayette Station, for the Katy stood from 1898 until being raised in 1979. An earlier station had burned in 1897. It might be noted that ultimately the route running through Howard County and beyond did not pan out as expected financially, and later it became, in essence, a secondary line. Meanwhile, the Katy's financial backers concluded that more profit could be had by routing train traffic through St. Louis. Construction of a main line across Missouri running east from St. Charles was completed 20 years later. That was in 1893. It ran across the north bank of the Missouri River until crossing at Boonville and proceeding on to Sedalia, eventually continuing to Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. Most of that 1893 riverside trackage that existed within Missouri evolved many years later, as you know, into our beloved Katy Trail, a development that came about following the MKT's decline in the 1980s and eventually its absorption by the Union Pacific in 1988. But at this point, the hiking and biking path was more than 100 years in the future. The coming of the railroad to Howard County in 1873 proved a boom for both Fayette and the two institutions of higher learning, Central College, now Central Methodist University, and Howard Payne College, a two-year junior college for women, which merged with Central in the mid-1920s. Students in those bygone days rarely had the option of going home for weekends or even holidays, except maybe for Christmas, and maybe not even then. When they did travel, it virtually always was by train. In the Katy's heyday, up to 6 trains a day came through Fayette, 3 north and 3 south. Much of the city's growth took place in the years following the Katy's arrival, and the town square in Fayette took on much of the appearance it has today. Residents seeking a larger shopping venue during that era, before the mid-1920s, rarely went to Columbia. They took the train to Moberly. And by the 1960s, however, the rails from Franklin to Moberly on through Fayette were not in the best of condition. And by that time, it was only an occasional freight that would traverse the route very slowly, perhaps once or twice a week as needed. Nonetheless, poor track conditions didn't stop some enterprising, albeit trespassing, Central Methodist students from doing a bit of joyriding in a track car on a warm spring night. Following is the description of one notable event from May 15, 1965, as described by then Fayette newspaper editor John Hurt. "Listen, my children, you shall hear of the midnight ride that happened here. On the 15th of May in 65, fortunately for all, are still alive. The sheriff was there to spread the alarm. The students were coming through fence and farm. 4 on a handcar, none by sea, and you on the opposite track shall be." The article goes on to note the midnight ride Friday on the railroad tracks is scheduled to stop in Magistrate Court in Fayette this afternoon. 4 students who reportedly took a motorized work car from the MKT yards at Franklin and ran it along the tracks have a date to appear in court today to answer charges of trespassing on railroad property. 3 of the 4 were injured when they jumped from the moving car after they'd been spotlighted by a highway patrolman who had been alerted by Howard County Sheriff Delger Wells. They were patients in Keller Hospital until Sunday, it happened on Saturday night, when they were all released and all eventually were getting along satisfactorily. Sheriff Wells reported that about 1:30 a.m. Saturday, he was driving to Fayette on Highway 240, and he observed the railroad work car going south toward New Franklin. He radioed the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and in response, Trooper David Terhoon set up an intercepting position on the Highway 5 rail crossing at Estill. When the railroad unit came into view, the trooper turned on his spotlight and his red flashing light. Robert Bovin of Webster Groves and E.C. Walker of Maryville, students at Central, and George Payne of St. Louis, a student at the University of Missouri, were injured. The 4th student, name was Howard Locke of St. Anne, a freshman no less, who attended Central, stayed with the car and stopped it. The boys had taken the work car from Fayette to Franklin and were starting back when they were discovered. Later, the students received relatively light fines in the Magistrate Court of Mira Funk. They also were disciplined by the college, however school officials refused to indicate in what way. Returning to more substantive matters, most observers agree that Central Methodist University would not have continued to exist and grow if it hadn't been for rail service coming to Fayette, even though train travel today is but a distant memory, at least in this area. But the trains did encompass a most colorful era in local history, with the railroad depot being the city's lifeblood in days gone by. As noted, the coming of the railroad to Howard County in 1873 proved a boon for both Fayette and its two institutions of higher learning. Train service opened up many new avenues of commerce in Howard County, and occasional specials transported students and townspeople, football games and other events, in addition to extra trains assigned to bring in students for the arrival of a new school year. There were also special trains taking folks to the State Fair in Sedalia, and specials transporting Missouri National Guard Company soldiers to summer maneuvers. From Fayette, students, salesmen often were called drummers, and local residents could board the train southbound and connect with the Katy's main east-west line at Franklin, or go north to Mobilique to connect with the Wabash. Those who went south from Fayette also could proceed across the Missouri River at Moonville and continue on to Sedalia, and then to points in Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, ultimately reaching Galveston on the Gulf Coast. Passengers arriving in Fayette were transported from the station to the town and to the square on Main Street via depot hacks. First, they were horse-drawn and later motorized. Guests often checked in at the venerable Hotel Howard at the southwest corner of Morrison and Church. The building was raised in 1981 and to make way for the Exchange National Bank. And we'll tell more about how train travel impacted this area in next week's broadcast of KPIP's Local Voices. A Glance Back, I'm Jim Steele reporting.
That was our Glance Back in Time with Jim Steele, president of the Boonslick Historical Society. This series with Jim Steele will continue every Monday from noon to 4 p.m. during Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
Thank you. meet in Mayfair, so the legends tell. Songbirds sing, winter turns to spring. Every winding street in Mayfair falls beneath the spell. I know such enchantment can be, 'cause it happened one evening to me. That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear that when you turned and smiled at me, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. The moon that lingered over London town, poor puzzled moon, he wore a frown. How could he know we two were so in love? The whole darned world seemed upside down. The streets of town were paved with stars. It was such a romantic affair. And as we said good night, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. As the tap dancing feet of a stair, and like an echo far away, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. I know, 'cause I was there that night in Berkeley.
This is KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. I'm Rachel, in for Jim Steele. On Tuesday, April 28, 1942, Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave the 21st of 30 public radio speeches that have become known as fireside chats. During these radio chats, the president would inform the American people and build public support for his administration's efforts during the Great Depression, World War II, and the enactment of New Deal policies. This is President Roosevelt's 21st fireside chat from Tuesday, April 28, 1942. It's titled, On Our National Economic Policy and Sacrifice.
It is nearly 5 months since we were attacked at Pearl Harbor. For the 2 years prior to that attack, this country had been gearing itself up to a high level of production of munitions. And yet our war efforts had done little to dislocate the normal lives of most of us. Since then, we have dispatched strong forces of our Army and Navy, several hundred thousand of them, to bases and battlefronts thousands of miles from home. We have stepped up our war production on a scale that is testing our industrial power, our engineering genius, and our economic structure to the utmost. We have had no illusions about the fact that this is a tough job and a long one. American warships are now in combat in the North and South Atlantic, in the Arctic, in the Mediterranean, in the Indian Ocean, and in the North and South Pacific. American troops have taken stations in South America, Greenland, Iceland, the British Isles, the Near East, the Middle East, and the Far East, the continent of Australia, and many islands of the Pacific. American war planes manned by Americans are flying in actual combat over all the continents and all the oceans. On the European front, the most important development of the past year has been, without question, the crushing counteroffensive on the part of the great armies of Russia against the powerful German army. These Russian forces have destroyed and are destroying more armed power of our enemies, troops, planes, tanks, and guns, than all the other United Nations put together. In the Mediterranean area, matters remain on the surface much as they were, but the situation there is receiving very careful attention. Recently, we've received news of a change in government in what we used to know as the Republic of France, a name dear to the hearts of all lovers of liberty, a name and an institution which we hope will soon be restored to full dignity. Throughout the Nazi occupation of France, we have hoped for the maintenance of a French government which would strive to regain independence, to reestablish the principles of liberty, equality, and fraternity, and to restore the historic culture of France. Our policy has been consistent from the very beginning. However, we are now greatly concerned lest those who have recently come to power may seek to force the brave French people into submission to Nazi despotism. The United Nations will take measures, if necessary, to prevent the use of French territory in any part of the world for military purposes by the Axis powers. The good people of France will readily understand that such action is essential for the United Nations to prevent assistance to the armies or navies or air forces of Germany or Italy or Japan. The overwhelming majority of the French people understand that the fight of the United Nations is fundamentally their fight, that our victory means the restoration of a free and independent France, and the saving of France from the slavery which would be imposed upon her by her external enemies and by her internal traitors. We know how the French people really feel. We know that a deep-seated determination to obstruct every step in the Axis plan extends from occupied France through Vichy France all the way to the people of their colonies in every ocean and on every continent. Our planes are helping in the defense of French colonies today, and soon American flying fortresses will be fighting for the liberation of the darkened continent of Europe itself. In all the occupied countries, there are men and women and even little children who have never stopped fighting, never stopped resisting, never stopped proving to the Nazis that their so-called new order can never be enforced upon free peoples. In the German and Italian peoples themselves, there's a growing conviction that the cause of Nazism and fascism is hopeless, that their political and military leaders have led them along the bitter road which leads not to world conquest, but to final defeat. They cannot fail to contrast the present frantic speeches of these leaders with their arrogant boastings of a year ago and 2 years ago. And on the other side of the world, in the Far East, we have passed through a phase of serious losses. We've inevitably lost control of a large portion of the Philippine Islands. But this whole nation pays tribute to the Filipino and American officers and men who held out so long on Bataan Peninsula, to those grim and gallant fighters who still hold Corregidor, where the flag flies, and to the forces that are still striking effectively at the enemy on Mindanao and other islands. The Malayan Peninsula and Singapore are in the hands of the enemy. The Netherlands East Indies are almost entirely occupied, though resistance there continues. Many other islands are in the possession of the Japanese. But there is good reason to believe that their southward advance has been checked. Australia, New Zealand, and much other territory will be bases for offensive action, and we are determined that the territory that has been lost will be regained. The Japanese are pressing their northward advance against Burma with considerable power, driving toward India and China. They have been opposed with great bravery by small British and Chinese forces, aided by American flyers. The news in Burma tonight is not good. The Japanese may cut the Burma road. But I want to say to the gallant people of China that no matter what advances the Japanese may make, ways will be found to deliver airplanes and munitions of war to the armies of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. We remember that the Chinese people were the first to stand up and fight against the aggressors in this war, and in the future, a still unconquerable China will play its proper role in maintaining peace and prosperity, not only in Eastern Asia, but in the whole world. For every advance that the Japanese have made since they started their frenzied career of conquest, they have had to pay a very heavy toll in warships, in transports, in planes, and in men. They are feeling the effects of those losses. It is even reported from Japan that somebody has dropped bombs on Tokyo and on other principal centers of Japanese war industries. If this be true, it is the first time in history that Japan has suffered such indignities. Although the treacherous attack on Pearl Harbor was the immediate cause of our entry into the war, that event found the American people spiritually prepared for war on a worldwide scale. We went into this war fighting. We know what we're fighting for. We realize that the war has become what Hitler originally proclaimed it to be, a total war. Not all of us can have the privilege of fighting our enemies in distant parts of the world. Not all of us can have the privilege of working in a munitions factory or a shipyard, or on the farms, or in oil fields or mines, producing the weapons or the raw materials that are needed by our armed forces. But there is one front and one battle where everyone in the United States, every man, woman, and child, is in action and will be privileged to remain in action throughout this war. That front is right here at home, in our daily lives, in our daily tasks. Here at home, everyone will have the privilege of making whatever self-denial is necessary, not only to supply our fighting men, but to keep the economic structure of our country fortified and secure during the war and after the war. This will require, of course, the abandonment not only of luxuries, but of many other creature comforts. Every loyal American is aware of his individual responsibility. Whenever I hear anyone saying the American people are complacent, they need to be aroused, I feel like asking him to come to Washington, to read the mail that floods into the White House and into all departments of this government. The one question that recurs through all these thousands of letters and messages is what more can I do to help my country in winning this war? To build the factories, to buy the materials, to pay the labor, to provide the transportation, to equip and feed and house the soldiers and sailors and marines, to do all the thousands of things necessary in a war, all cost a lot of money. More money than has ever been spent by any nation at any time in the long history of the world. We are now spending, solely for war purposes, the sum of about $100 million every day in the week. But before this year is over, that almost unbelievable rate of expenditure will be doubled. All of this money has to be spent, and spent quickly, if we are to produce, within the time now available, the enormous quantities of weapons of war which we need. But the spending of these tremendous sums presents grave danger of disaster to our national economy. When your government continues to spend these unprecedented sums for munitions, month by month and year by year, that money goes into the pocketbooks and bank accounts of the people of the United States. At the same time, raw materials and many manufactured goods are necessarily taken away from civilian use, and machinery and factories are being converted to war production. You do not have to be a professor of mathematics or economics to see that if people with plenty of cash start bidding against each other for scarce goods, the price of those goods goes up. Yesterday, I submitted to the Congress of the United States a seven-point program, a program of general principles, which, taken together, could be called the National Economic Policy for attaining the great objective of keeping the cost of living down. I repeat them now to you in substance. First, we must, through heavier taxes, keep personal and corporate profits at a low, reasonable rate. Second, we must fix ceilings on prices and rents. Third, we must stabilize wages. Fourth, we must stabilize farm prices. Fifth, we must put more billions into war bonds. Sixth, we must ration all essential commodities which are scarce. And seventh, we must discourage installment buying and encourage paying off debts and mortgages. I do not think it is necessary to repeat what I said yesterday to the Congress in discussing these general principles. The important thing to remember is that each one of these points is dependent on the others if the whole program is to work. Some people are already taking the position that every one of the 7 points is correct, except the 1 point which steps on their own individual toes. A few seem very willing to approve self-denial on the part of their neighbors. The only effective course of action is a simultaneous attack on all of the factors which increase the cost of living in one comprehensive, all-embracing program covering prices and profits and wages and taxes and debts. The blunt fact is that every single person in the United States is going to be affected by this program. Some of you will be affected more directly by one or two of these restrictive measures, but all of you will be affected indirectly by all of them. Are you a businessman, or do you own stock in a business corporation? Well, your profits are going to be cut down to a reasonably low level by taxation. your income will be subject to higher taxes. Indeed, in these days, when every available dollar should go to the war effort, I do not think that any American citizen should have a net income in excess of $25,000 per year after payment of taxes. Are you a retailer or a wholesaler or a manufacturer or a farmer or a landlord? Ceilings are being placed on the prices at which you can sell your goods or rent your property. Do you work for wages? You will have to forego higher wages for your particular job for the duration of the war. All of us are used to spending money for things that we want. Things, however, which are not absolutely essential. We will all have to forego that kind of spending because we must put every dime and every dollar we can possibly spare out of our earnings into war bonds and stamps. Because the demands of the war effort require the rationing of goods of which there is not enough to go round. Because the stopping of purchases of non-essentials will release thousands of workers who are needed in the war effort. As I told the Congress yesterday, sacrifice is not exactly the proper word with which to describe this program of self-denial. When at the end of this great struggle, we shall have saved our free way of life, we shall have made no sacrifice. The price for civilization must be paid in hard work and sorrow and blood. The price is not too high. If you doubt it, ask those millions who live today under the tyranny of Hitlerism. Ask the workers of France and Norway and the Netherlands, whipped to labor by the lash, whether the stabilization of wages is too great a sacrifice. Ask the farmers of Poland and Denmark and Czechoslovakia and France, looted of their livestock, starving while their own crops are stolen from their land. Ask them whether parity prices are too great a sacrifice. Ask the businessmen of Europe, whose enterprises have been stolen from their owners, whether the limitation of profits and personal incomes is too great a sacrifice. Ask the women and children, whom Hitler is starving, whether the rationing of tires and gasoline and sugar is too great a sacrifice. We do not have to ask them. They have already given us their agonized answer. This great war effort must be carried through to its victorious conclusion by the indomitable will and determination of the people as one great whole. It must not be impeded by the faint of heart. It must not be impeded by those who put their own selfish interests above the interests of the nation. It must not be impeded by those who pervert honest criticism into falsification of fact. It must not be impeded by self-styled experts, either in economics or military problems, who know neither true figures nor geography itself. It must not be impeded by a few bogus patriots who use the sacred freedom of the press to echo the sentiments of the propagandists in Tokyo and Berlin. And above all, it shall not be imperiled by the handful of noisy traitors, betrayers of America, betrayers of Christianity itself, would-be dictators who in their hearts and souls have yielded to Hitlerism and would have this republic do likewise. I shall use all of the executive power that I have to carry out the policy laid down. If it becomes necessary to ask for any additional legislation in order to attain our objective of preventing a spiral in the cost of living, I shall do so. I know the American farmer, the American workman, and the American businessman. I know that they will gladly embrace this economy and equality of sacrifice, satisfied that it is necessary for the most vital and compelling motive in all their lives, winning through to victory. Never in the memory of man has there been a war in which the courage, the endurance, and the loyalty of civilians played so vital a part. Many thousands of civilians all over the world have been and are being killed or maimed by enemy action. Indeed, it was the fortitude of the common people of Britain under fire which enabled that island to stand and prevented Hitler from winning the war in 1940. The ruins of London and Coventry and other cities are today the proudest monuments to British heroism. Our own American civilian population is now relatively safe from such disasters, and to an ever-increasing extent, our soldiers, sailors, and Marines are fighting with great bravery and great skill on far distant fronts to make sure that we shall remain safe. I should like to tell you one or two stories about the men we have in our armed forces. There is, for example, Dr. Corydon M. Wassell. He was a missionary, well known for his good works in China. He is a simple, modest, retiring man, nearly 60 years old, but he entered the service of his country and was commissioned a lieutenant commander in the Navy. Dr. Wassell was assigned to duty in Java, caring for wounded officers and men of the cruisers Houston and Marblehead, which had been in heavy action in the Java Seas. When the Japanese advanced across the island, it was decided to evacuate as many as possible of the wounded to Australia. But about 12 of the men were so badly wounded that they couldn't be moved. Dr. Wassell remained with them, knowing that he would be captured by the enemy. But he decided to make a last desperate attempt to get the men out of Java. He asked each of them if he wished to take the chance, and every one agreed. He first had to get the 12 men to the seacoast, 50 miles away. To do this, he had to improvise stretchers for the hazardous journey. The men were suffering severely, but Dr. Wassell kept them alive by his skill, inspired them by his own courage. And as the official report said, Dr. Wassell was almost like a Christ-like shepherd devoted to his flock. On the seacoast, he embarked the men on a little Dutch ship. They were bombed. They were machine-gunned by waves of Japanese planes. Dr. Wassell took virtual command of the ship and by great skill avoided destruction, hiding in little bays and little inlets. A few days later, Dr. Wassell and his small flock of wounded men reached Australia safely. And today, Dr. Wassell wears the Navy Cross. Another story concerns a ship. A ship rather than an individual man. You may remember the tragic sinking of the submarine, the United States ship Squalus, off the New England coast in the summer of 1939. Some of the crew were lost, but others were saved by the speed and the efficiency of the surface rescue crews. The Squalus itself was tediously raised from the bottom of the sea.
She was repaired, put back into commission, and eventually she sailed again under a new name, the United States ship Sailfish. Today, she is a potent and effective unit of our submarine fleet in the Southwest Pacific.
The Sailfish has covered many thousands of miles in operations in those far waters. She has sunk a Japanese destroyer. She has torpedoed a Japanese cruiser. She has made torpedo hits, two of them, on a Japanese aircraft carrier. Three of the enlisted men of our Navy who went down with the Squalus in 1939 and were rescued are today serving on the same ship, the United States ship Sailfish, in this war. It seems to me that it's heartening to know that the Squalus, once given up as lost, rose from the depths to fight for our country in time of peril. One more story that I've heard only this morning. This is a story of one of our Army flying fortresses operating in the Western Pacific. The pilot of this plane is a modest young man, proud of his crew, for one of the toughest fights a bomber has yet experienced. The bomber departed from its base as part of a flight of five bombers to attack Japanese transports that were landing troops against us in the Philippines. When they had gone about halfway to their destination, one of the motors of this bomber went out of commission. The young pilot lost contact with the other bombers. The crew, however, got the motor working, got it going again, and the plane proceeded on its mission alone. By the time it arrived at its target, the other four flying fortresses had already passed over, had dropped their bombs, and had stirred up the hornet's nest of Japanese Zero planes. 18 Zero fighters attacked our one flying fortress. Despite this mass attack, our plane proceeded on its mission and dropped all of its bombs on six Japanese transports, which were lined up along the docks. As it turned back on its homeward journey, a running fight between the bomber and the 18 Japanese pursuit planes continued for 75 miles. Four pursuit planes of the Japs attacked simultaneously at each side. Four were shot down with the side guns. During this fight, the bomber's radio operator was killed, the engineer's right hand was shot off, and one gunner was crippled, leaving only one man available to operate both side guns. Although wounded in one hand, this gunner alternately manned both side guns, bringing down three more Japanese Zero planes. While this was going on, one engine on the American bomber was shot out. One gas tank was hit. The radio was shot off, and the oxygen system was entirely destroyed. Out of 11 control cables, all but four were shot away. The rear landing wheel was blown off entirely, and the two front wheels were both shot flat. The fight continued until the remaining Japanese pursuit ships exhausted their ammunition and turned back. With two engines gone and the plane practically out of control, the American bomber returned to its base after dark and made an emergency landing. The mission had been accomplished. The name of that pilot is Captain Hewitt T. Whalus of the United States Army. He comes from a place called Menard, Texas, with a population of 2,375. He has been awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, and I hope that he's listening. These stories I have told you are not exceptional.
They're typical examples of individual heroism and skill. As we here at home contemplate our own duties, our own responsibilities, let us think and think hard of the example which is being set for us by our fighting men. Our soldiers and sailors are members of well-disciplined units, but they're still and forever individuals. Free individuals. They're farmers and workers, businessmen, professional men, artists, clerks. They are the United States of America. That is why they fight. We too are the United States of America. That is why we must work and sacrifice. It is for them. It is for us. It is for victory.
That was President Franklin D. Roosevelt's 21st Fireside Chat, entitled On Our National Economic Policy and Sacrifice. Next week, we will explore FDR's 22nd Fireside Chat from Monday, September 7th, 1942, entitled On Inflation and Progress of the War. I'm Rachel Steele, in for Jim Steele, on 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. Thanks to the Boonslick Historical Society for bringing us this historical content on Local Voices with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.